He is in a blue funk, of course, suggested at once that we should go off to Pretoria. Then, when I had told him kindly but firmly that we were going to remain here, he went to the other extreme, wished he had his rifle here, and began bucking about some bridge he guarded during the Great War, a railway bridge at Little Pudcombe Junction or something of that sort. I soon cut that short by telling him to unpack the big typewriter. I thought that would keep him employed for some time, because the typewriter was sure to have gone wrong. It always does. And he would have to take it somewhere to be mended. But I had forgotten Paget's powers of being in the right. "I have already unpacked all the cases, Sir Eustace. The typewriter is in perfect condition." "What do you mean, all the cases?" "The two small cases as well." "I wish you wouldn't be so officious, Paget. Those small cases were no business of yours. They belong to Mrs. Blair." Paget looked crestfallen. He hates to make a mistake. "So you can just pack them up again neatly," I continued. "After that, you can go out and look around. Joburg will probably be a heap of smoking ruins by tomorrow, so it may be your last chance." I thought that that would get rid of him successfully for the morning, at any rate.
"There is something I want to say to you when you have the leisure, Sir Eustace."
"I haven't got it now," I said hastily. "At this minute I have absolutely no leisure whatsoever." Paget retired. "By the way," I called after him, "what was there in those cases of Mrs. Blair's?"
"Some fur rugs and a couple of fur hats, I think."
"That's right," I assented. "She bought them on the train. They are hats of a kind, though I hardly wonder at your not recognising them. I dare say she's going to wear one of them at Ascot. What else was there?"
"Some rolls of film and some baskets. A lot of baskets."
"There would be," I assured him. "Mrs. Blair is the kind of woman who never buys less than a dozen or so of anything."
"I think that's all, Sir Eustace, except some miscellaneous odds and ends, a motor veil and some odd gloves, that sort of thing."
"If you hadn't been a born idiot, Paget, you would have seen from the start that those couldn't possibly be my belongings."
"I thought some of them might belong to Miss Pettigrew."
"Ah, that reminds me. What do you mean by picking me out such a doubtful character as a secretary?" And I told him about the searching cross-examination I'd been put through. Immediately I was sorry. I saw a glint in his eye that I know only too well. I changed the conversation hurriedly, but it was too late. Paget was on the warpath. He next proceeded to bore me with a long, pointless story about the Kilmorden. It was about a roll of films and a wager. The roll of films being thrown through a porthole in the middle of the night by some steward who ought to have known better. I hate horseplay. I told Paget so, and he began to tell me the story all over again. He tells the story extremely badly anyway. It was a long time before I could make head or tail of this one. I did not see him again until lunchtime. Then he came in brimming over with excitement, like a bloodhound on the scent. I never have cared for bloodhounds. The upshot of it all was that he had seen Raeburn. "What?" I cried, startled. Yes, he had caught sight of someone whom he was sure was Raeburn crossing the street. Paget had followed him. "And who do you think I saw him stop and speak to?" "Miss Pettigrew." "What?"
"Yes, Sir Eustace, and that's not all. I've been making inquiries about her."
"Wait a bit. What happened to Raeburn?"
"He and Miss Pettigrew went into that corner curio shop."
I uttered an involuntary exclamation. Paget stopped inquiringly. "Nothing," I said. "Go on."
"I waited outside for ages, but they didn't come out. At last I went in. Sir Eustace, there was no one in the shop. There must be another way out." I stared at him. "As I was saying, I came back to the hotel and made some inquiries about Miss Pettigrew." Paget lowered his voice and breathed hard, as he always does when he wants to be confidential. "Sir Eustace, a man was seen coming out of her room last night."
I raised my eyebrows.
"And I always regarded her as a lady of such eminent respectability," I murmured. Paget went on without heeding. I went straight up and searched her room. What do you think I found?
I shook my head.
This. Paget held up a safety razor and a stick of shaving soap. what should a woman want with these?
I don't suppose Paget ever reads the advertisements in the high-class ladies' papers. I do. Whilst not proposing to argue with him on the subject, I refuse to accept the presence of the razor as proof positive of Miss Pettigrew's sex. Paget is so hopelessly behind the times, I should not have been at all surprised if he had produced a cigarette case to support his theory. However, even Paget has his limits.
You're not convinced, Sir Eustace. What do you say to this?
I inspected the article, which he dangled aloft triumphantly. It looks like hair, I remarked distastefully.
It is hair. I think it's what they call a toupee.
Indeed, I commented.
Now, are you convinced that that Pettigrew woman is a man in disguise?
Really, my dear Paget, I think I am. I might have known it by her feet.
Then that's that. And now, Sir Eustace, I want to speak to you about my private affairs. I cannot doubt from your hints and your continual allusions to the time I was in Florence that you have found me out.
At last, the mystery of what Paget did in Florence is going to be revealed. Make a clean breast of it, my dear fellow, I said kindly. Make the best way.
Thank you, Sir Eustace.
Is it her husband, annoying fellows' husbands, always turning up when they're least expected?
I fail to follow you, Sir Eustace. Whose husband?
The lady's husband.
What lady?
God bless my soul, Paget, the lady you met in Florence. There must have been a lady. Don't tell me that you merely robbed a church or stabbed an Italian in the back because you didn't like his face.
I am quite at a loss to understand you, Sir Eustace. I suppose you are joking.
I am an amusing fellow sometimes, when I take the trouble, but I can assure you that I am not trying to be funny this minute.
I hoped that, as I was a good way off, you had not recognised me, Sir Eustace.
Recognised you where?
At Marlowe, Sir Eustace.
At Marlowe? What the devil were you doing at Marlowe?
I thought you understood that...
I'm beginning to understand less and less. Go back to the beginning of the story and start again. You went to Florence.
Then you don't know after all, and you didn't recognise me.
As far as I can judge, you seem to have given yourself away needlessly, made a coward of by your conscience. But I shall be able to tell better when I've heard the whole story. Now then, take a deep breath and start again. You went to Florence.
But I didn't go to Florence. That is just it.
Well, where did you go then?
I went home, to Marlowe.
What the devil did you want to go to Marlowe for?
I wanted to see my wife. She was in delicate health and expecting...
Your wife? But I didn't know you were married.
No, Sir Eustace, that is just what I am telling you. I deceived you in this matter.
How long have you been married?
Just over 8 years. I had been married just 6 months when I became your secretary. I did not want to lose the post. A resident secretary is not supposed to have a wife, so I suppressed the fact.
You take my breath away, I remarked. Where has she been all these years?
We have had a small bungalow on the river at Marlowe, quite close to the mill house, for over 5 years.
God bless my soul, I muttered. Any children?
4 children, Sir Eustace.
I gazed at him in a kind of stupor. I might have known all along that a man like Paget couldn't have a guilty secret. The respectability of Paget has always been my bane.
That's just the kind of secret he would have, a wife and 4 children.
Have you told this to anyone else? I demanded at last, when I had gazed at him in fascinated interest for quite a long while.
Only Miss Bedingfeld. She came to the station at Kimberley.
I continued to stare at him. He fidgeted under my glance.
I hope, Sir Eustace, that you are not seriously annoyed.
My dear fellow, I said, I don't mind telling you here and now that you're blinking well torn it.
I went out seriously ruffled. As I passed the corner curio shop, I was assailed by a sudden irresistible temptation and went in.
The proprietor came forward, obsequiously rubbing his hands.
Can I show you something? Furs? Curios?
I want something quite out of the ordinary, I said. It's for a special occasion. Will you show me what you've got?
Perhaps he will come into my back room. We have many specialities there.
That is where I made a mistake, and I thought I was going to be so clever. I followed him through the swinging portieres.
Chapter 32. Anne's narrative resumed. I had great trouble with Suzanne. She argued, she pleaded, she even wept before she would let me carry out my plan. But in the end, I got my own way. She promised to carry out my instructions to the letter and came down to the station to bid me a tearful farewell. I arrived at my destination the following morning early. I was met by a short, black-bearded Dutchman whom I had never seen before. He had a car waiting, and we drove off. There was a queer booming in the distance, and I asked him what it was.
"Guns," he answered laconically.
So there was fighting going on in Joburg. I gathered that our objective was a spot somewhere in the suburbs of the city. We turned and twisted and made several detours to get there, and every minute the guns were nearer. It was an exciting time. At last we stopped before a somewhat ramshackle building. The door was opened by a Kaffir boy. My guide signed to me to enter. I stood irresolute in the dingy square hall. The man passed me and threw open a door.
"The young lady to see Mr. Harry Rayburn," he said,
and laughed. Thus announced, I passed in. The room was sparsely furnished and smelt of cheap tobacco smoke. Behind a desk, a man sat writing. He looked up and raised his eyebrows.
"Dear me," he said, "if it isn't Miss Bedingfeld."
"I must be seeing double," I apologized. "Is it Mr. Chichester, or is it Miss Pettigrew? There is an extraordinary resemblance to both of them."
"Both characters are in abeyance for the moment. I have doffed my petticoats and my cloth likewise. Won't you sit down?"
I accepted a seat composedly. "It would seem," I remarked, "that I have come to the wrong address."
"From your point of view, I am afraid you have. Really, Miss Bedingfeld, to fall into the trap a second time."
"It was not very bright of me," I admitted meekly. Something about my manner seemed to puzzle him.
"You hardly seem upset about the occurrence," he remarked dryly.
"Would my going into heroics have any effect upon you?" I asked.
"It certainly would not."
"My great aunt Jane always used to say that a true lady was neither shocked nor surprised at anything that might happen," I murmured dreamily. "I endeavour to live up to her precepts." I read Mr. Chichester Pettigrew's opinion so plainly written on his face that I hastened into speech once more. "You really are positively marvellous at make-up," I said generously. "All the time you were Miss Pettigrew, I never recognised you, even when you broke your pencil in the shock of seeing me climb upon the train at Cape Town." He tapped upon the desk with the pencil he was holding in his hand at the minute.
"All this is very well in its way, but we must get to the business. Perhaps, Miss Bedingfeld, you can guess why we required your presence here?"
"You will excuse me," I said, "but I never do business with anyone but principals." I had read the phrase, or something like it, in a moneylender's circular, and I was rather pleased with it. It certainly had a devastating effect upon Mr. Chichester Pettigrew. He opened his mouth and then shut it again. I beamed upon him. "My great-uncle George's maxim," I added as an afterthought. "Great Aunt Jane's husband, you know. He made knobs for brass beds." I doubt if Chichester Pettigrew had ever been ragged before. He didn't like it at all.
"I think you would be wise to alter your tone, young lady."
I did not reply, but yawned, a delicate little yawn that hinted at intense boredom.
"What the devil," he began forcibly.
I interrupted him. "I can assure you it's no good shouting at me. We are only wasting time here. I have no intention of talking with underlings. You will save a lot of time and annoyance by taking me straight to Sir Eustace Pedler."
"To—"
He looked dumbfounded. "Yes," I said, "Sir Eustace Pedler."
Excuse me.
He bolted from the room like a rabbit. I took advantage of the respite to open my bag and powder my nose thoroughly. Also, I settled my hat at a more becoming angle. Then I settled myself to wait with patience for my enemy's return. He reappeared in a subtly chastened mood.
"Will you come this way, Miss Bedingfeld?"
I followed him up the stairs. He knocked at the door of a room. A brisk, "Come in," sounded from inside, and he opened the door and motioned to me to pass inside. Sir Eustace Pedler sprang up to greet me, genial and smiling.
"Well, well, Miss Anne," he shook me warmly by the hand. "I'm delighted to see you. Come and sit down. Not tired after your journey? That's good."
He sat down facing me, still beaming. It left me rather at a loss. His manner was so completely natural.
"Quite right to insist on being brought straight to me," he went on. "Minx is a fool, a clever actor, but a fool. That was Minx you saw downstairs."
"Oh, really?" I said feebly.
"And now," said Sir Eustace cheerfully, "let's get down to facts. How long have you known that I was the colonel?"
"Ever since Mr. Paget told me that he had seen you in Marlowe when you were supposed to be in Cannes." Sir Eustace nodded ruefully.
"Yes, I told the fool he'd blinking well torn it. He didn't understand, of course. His old mind was set on whether I'd recognised him. It never occurred to him to wonder what I was doing down there. A piece of sheer bad luck, that was. I arranged it all so carefully, sending him off to Florence, telling the hotel I was going over to Nice for one night or possibly two. Then, by the time the murder was discovered, I was back in Cannes, with nobody dreaming that I'd ever left the Riviera."
He still spoke quite naturally and unaffectedly. I had to pinch myself to understand that this was all real, that the man in front of me was really that deep-dyed criminal, the Colonel. I followed things out in my mind. "Then it was you who tried to throw me overboard on the Kilmorden," I said slowly. "It was you that Paget followed up on deck that night." He shrugged his shoulders.
"I apologise, my dear child, I really do. I always liked you, but you were so confoundedly interfering. I couldn't have all my plans brought to naught by a chit of a girl."
"I think your plan at the Falls was really the cleverest," I said, endeavouring to look at the thing in a detached fashion. "I would have been ready to swear anywhere that you were in the hotel when I went out. Seeing is believing in future."
"Yes, Minx had one of his greatest successes as Miss Pettigrew, and he can imitate my voice quite credibly."
"There is one thing I should like to know."
"Yes?"
"How did you induce Paget to engage her?"
"Oh, that was quite simple. She met Paget in the doorway of the Trade Commissioner's office or the Chamber of Mines, or wherever it was he went. Told him I had phoned down in a hurry and that she had been selected by the government department in question. Paget swallowed it like a lamb."
"You're very frank," I said, studying him.
"There's no earthly reason why I shouldn't be."
I didn't like the sound of that. I hastened to put my own interpretation on it. "You believe in the success of this revolution. You've burnt your boats."
"For an otherwise intelligent young woman, that's a singularly unintelligent remark. No, my dear child, I do not believe in this revolution. I give it a couple of days longer, and it will fizzle out ignominiously."
"Not one of your successors, in fact," I said nastily.
"Like all women, you've no idea of business. The job I took on was to supply certain explosives and arms, heavily paid for, to foment feeling generally, and to incriminate certain people up to the hilt. I've carried out my contract with complete success, and I was careful to be paid in advance. I took special care over the whole thing, as I intended it to be my last contract before retiring from business. As for burning my boats, as you call it, I simply don't know what you mean. I'm not the rebel chief, or anything of that kind. I'm a distinguished English visitor who had the misfortune to go nosing into a certain curio shop and saw a little more than he was meant to, and so the poor fellow was kidnapped. Tomorrow, or the day after, when circumstances permit, I shall be found tied up somewhere in a pitiable state of terror and starvation."
"Ah," I said slowly, "but what about me?"
"That's just it," said Sir Eustace softly. "What about you? I've got you here. I don't want to rub it in any way, but I've got you here very neatly. The question is, what am I going to do with you? The simplest way of disposing of you, and I may add the pleasantest to myself, is the way of marriage. Wives can't accuse their husbands, you know, and I'd rather like a pretty young wife to hold my hand and glance at me out of liquid eyes. Don't flash them at me so. You quite frighten me. I see that the plan does not commend itself to you.
It does not, Sir Eustace sighed.
A pity. But I am no Adelphi villain. The usual trouble, I suppose. You love another, as the books say.
I love another.
I thought as much. First, I thought it was that long-legged, pompous ass race. But I suppose it's a young hero who fished you out of the falls that night. Women have no taste. Neither of those two have half the brains that I have. I'm such an easy person to underestimate.
I think he was right about that. Although I knew well enough the kind of man he was, and must be, I could not bring myself to realize it. He had tried to kill me on more than one occasion. He had actually killed another woman, and he was responsible for endless other deeds of which I knew nothing. And yet I was quite unable to bring myself into the frame of mind for appreciating his deeds as they deserved. I could not think of him as other than our amusing, genial, travelling companion. I could not even feel frightened of him, and yet I knew he was capable of having me murdered in cold blood, if it struck him as necessary. The only parallel I can think of is the case of Stevenson's Long John Silver. He must have been much the same kind of man.
Well, well,
said this extraordinary person, leaning back in his chair.
It's a pity that the idea of being Lady Pedler doesn't appeal to you. The other alternatives are rather crude.
I felt a nasty feeling going up and down my spine. Of course I had known all along that I was taking a big risk, but the prize had seemed worth it. Would things turn out as I had calculated, or would they not?
The fact of the matter is, Sir Eustace was continuing, I've a weakness for you. I really don't want to proceed to extremes. Suppose you tell me the whole story from the very beginning, and let's see what we can make of it. But no romancing, mind. I want the truth.
I was not going to make any mistake over that. I had a great deal of respect for Sir Eustace's shrewdness. It was a moment for the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth. I told him the whole story, omitting nothing, up to the moment of my rescue by Harry. When I had finished, he nodded his head in approval.
Wise girl, you've made a clean breast of the thing. And let me tell you, I should soon have caught you out if you hadn't. A lot of people wouldn't believe your story anyway, especially the beginning part, but I do. You're the kind of girl who would start off like that, at a moment's notice, on the slenderest of motives. You've had amazing luck, of course, but sooner or later the amateur runs up against the professional, and then the result is a foregone conclusion. I am the professional. I started on this business when I was quite a youngster. All things considered, it seemed to me a good way of getting rich quickly. I always could think things out and devise ingenious schemes, and I never made the mistake of trying to carry out my schemes myself. Always employ the expert. That has been my motto. The one time I departed from it, I came to grief. But I couldn't trust anyone to do that job for me. Nadina knew too much. I'm an easygoing man, kind-hearted and good-tempered, so long as I'm not thwarted. Nadina both thwarted me and threatened me, just as I was at the apex of a successful career. Once she was dead and the diamonds were in my possession, I was safe. I've come to the conclusion now that I bungled the job. That idiot Paget with his wife and family. My fault. It tickled my sense of humour to employ the fellow with his Cinquecento poisonous face and his mid-Victorian soul. A maxim for you, my dear Anne. Don't let your sense of humour carry you away. For years I've had an instinct that it would be wise to get rid of Paget, but the fellow was so hard-working and conscientious that I honestly couldn't find an excuse for sacking him. So I let things drift. But we're wandering from the point. The question is what to do with you. Your narrative was admirably clear, but there is one thing that still escapes me. Where are the diamonds now?
Harry Raeburn has them, I said, watching him. His face did not change. It retained its expression of sardonic good humour.
I want those diamonds.
I don't see much chance of your getting them, I replied.
Don't you? Now I do. I don't want it to be unpleasant, but I should like you to reflect that a dead girl, or so found in this quarter of the city, will occasion no surprise. There's a man downstairs who does these sort of jobs very neatly. Now, you're a sensible young woman. What I propose is this. You will sit down and write to Harry Raeburn, telling him to join you here and bring the diamonds with him.
I won't do anything of the kind.
Don't interrupt your elders. I propose to make a bargain with you. The diamonds in exchange for your life. And don't make any mistake about it. Your life is absolutely in my power.
And Harry?
I'm far too tender-hearted to part two young lovers. He shall go free too. On the understanding, of course, that neither of you interfere with me in the future.
And what guarantee have I that you will keep your side of the bargain?
None whatever, my dear girl. You'll have to trust me and hope for the best. Of course, if you're in an heroic mood and prefer annihilation, that's another matter.
This was what I had been playing for. I was careful not to jump at the bait. Gradually, I allowed myself to be bullied and cajoled into yielding. I wrote at Sir Eustace's dictation. Dear Harry, I think I see a chance of establishing your innocence beyond any possible doubt. Please follow my instructions minutely. Go to Agrisato's curio shop. Ask to see something out of the ordinary, for a special occasion. The man will then ask you to come into the back room. Go with him. You will find a messenger who will bring you to me. Do exactly as he tells you. Be sure and bring the diamonds with you. Not a word to anyone. Sir Eustace stopped.
I leave the fancy touches to your imagination, he remarked. But be careful to make no mistakes.
Yours for ever and ever, Anne, will be sufficient, I remarked. I wrote in the words. Sir Eustace stretched out his hand for the letter and read it through.
That seems all right. Now the address.
I gave it him. It was that of a small shop which received letters and telegrams for a consideration. He struck the bell upon the table with his hand. Chichester Pettigrew, alias Minx, answered the summons.
This letter is to go immediately, the usual route.
Very well, Colonel. He looked at the name on the envelope. Sir Eustace was watching him keenly.
A friend of yours, I think. Of mine? The man seemed startled. You had a prolonged conversation with him in Johannesburg yesterday.
A man came up and questioned me about your movements and those of Colonel Race. I gave him misleading information.
Excellent, my dear fellow, excellent, said Sir Eustace genially. My mistake.
I chanced to look at Chichester Pettigrew as he left the room. He was white to the lips, as though in deadly terror. No sooner was he outside than Sir Eustace picked up a speaking tube that rested by his elbow and spoke down it.
That you, Schwart? Watch Minx. He's not to leave the house without orders.
He put the speaking tube down again and frowned, slightly tapping the table with his hand. May I ask you a few questions, Sir Eustace? I said, after a minute or two of silence.
Certainly. What excellent nerves you have, Anne. You're capable of taking an intelligent interest in things when most girls would be sniffling and wringing their hands.
Why did you take Harry as your secretary instead of giving him up to the police?
I wanted those cursed diamonds. Nadina, the little devil, was playing off your Harry against me. Unless I gave her the price she wanted, she threatened to sell them back to him. That was another mistake I made. I thought she'd have them with her that day. But she was too clever for that. Carton, her husband, was dead too. I'd no clue whatsoever as to where the diamonds were hidden. Then I managed to get a copy of a wireless message sent to Nadina by someone on board the Kilmorden, either Carton or Raeburn. I didn't know which. It was a duplicate of that piece of paper you picked up. 17-1-22, it ran. I took it to be an appointment with Raeburn, and when he was so desperate to get aboard the Kilmorden, I was convinced that I was right. so I pretended to swallow his statements and let him come. I kept a pretty sharp watch upon him and hoped that I should learn more. Then I found Minx trying to play a lone hand and interfering with me. I soon stopped that. He came to heel all right. It was annoying not getting Cabin 17, and it worried me not being able to place you. Were you the innocent young girl you seemed, or were you not? When Rayburn set out to keep the appointment that night, Minx was told off to intercept him. Minx muffed it, of course.
But why did the wireless message say 17 instead of 71?
I've thought that out. Carton must have given that wireless operator his own memorandum to copy off onto the form, and he never read the copy through. The operator made the same mistake we all did and read it as 17-1-22 instead of 1-71-22. The thing I don't know is how Minx got on to Cabin 17. It must have been sheer instinct.
And the dispatch to General Smuts, who tempered with that?
My dear Anne, you don't suppose I was going to have a lot of my plans given away without making an effort to save them? With an escaped murderer as a secretary, I had no hesitation whatever in substituting blanks. Nobody would think of suspecting poor old Pedler.
What about Colonel Race?
Yes, that was a nasty jar. When Paget told me he was a Secret Service fellow, I had an unpleasant feeling down the spine. I remembered that he'd been nosing around Medina in Paris during the war, and I had a horrible suspicion that he was out after me. I don't like the way he's stuck to me ever since. He's one of those strong, silent men who have always got something up their sleeve.
A whistle sounded. Sir Eustace picked up the tube, listened for a minute or two, then answered,
"Very well. I'll see him now." "Business," he remarked. "Miss Anne, let me show you your room."
He ushered me into a small, shabby apartment. A Kaffir boy brought up my small suitcase, and Sir Eustace, urging me to ask for anything I wanted, withdrew, the picture of a courteous host. A can of hot water was on the washstand, and I proceeded to unpack a few necessaries. Something hard and unfamiliar in my sponge bag puzzled me greatly. I untied the string and looked inside. To my utter amazement, I drew out a small pearl-handled revolver. It hadn't been there when I started from Kimberley. I examined the thing gingerly. It appeared to be loaded. I handled it with a comfortable feeling. It was a useful thing to have in a house such as this. But modern clothes are quite unsuited to the carrying of firearms. In the end, I pushed it gingerly into the top of my stocking. It made a terrible bulge, and I expected every minute that it would go off and shoot me in the leg. But it really seemed the only place. Chapter 33. I was not summoned to Sir Eustace's presence until late in the afternoon. 11 o'clock tea and a substantial lunch had been served to me in my own apartment, and I felt fortified for further conflict. Sir Eustace was alone. He was walking up and down the room. There was a gleam in his eye and a restlessness in his manner which did not escape me. He was exultant about something. There was a subtle change in his manner towards me.
"I have news for you. Your young man is on his way. He will be here in a few minutes. Moderate your transports. I have something more to say. You attempted to deceive me this morning. I warned you that you would be wise to stick to the truth, and up to a certain point you obeyed me. Then you ran off the rails. You attempted to make me believe that the diamonds were in Harry Rayburn's possession. At the time, I accepted your statement because it facilitated my task. The task of inducing you to decoy Harry Rayburn here. But, my dear Anne, the diamonds have been in my possession ever since I left the Falls, though I only discovered the fact yesterday."
"You know," I gasped.
"It may interest you to hear that it was Paget who gave the show away. He insisted on boring me with a long, pointless story about a wager and a tin of films. It didn't take me long to put two and two together. Mrs. Blair's distrust of Colonel Race, her agitation, her entreaty that I would take care of her souvenirs for her." The excellent Paget had already unfastened the cases through an excess of zeal. "Before leaving the hotel, I simply transferred all the rolls of films to my own pocket.
They are in the corner there. I admit that I haven't had time to examine them yet, but I noticed that one is a totally different weight to the others, rattles in a peculiar fashion, and has evidently been stuck down with secotine, which will necessitate the use of a tin opener. The case seems clear, does it not? And now, you see, I have you both nicely in the trap. It's a pity that you didn't take kindly to the idea of becoming Lady Pedler.
I did not answer. I stood looking at him. There was the sound of feet on the stairs. The door was flung open, and Harry Raeburn was hustled into the room between two men. Sir Eustace flung me a look of triumph.
According to plan, he said softly, you amateurs will pit yourselves against the professionals. What's the meaning of this? Cried Harry hoarsely. It means that you have walked into my parlour, said the spider to the fly, remarked Sir Eustace facetiously. My dear Raeburn, you are extraordinarily unlucky.
Who said I could come safely, Anne?
Do not reproach her, my dear fellow. That note was written at my dictation, and the lady could not help herself. She would have been wiser not to write it, but I did not tell her so at the time. You followed her instructions, went to the curio shop, were taken through the secret passage from the back room, and found yourself in the hands of your enemies.
Harry looked at me. I understood his glance, and edged nearer to Sir Eustace.
Yes, murmured the latter.
Decidedly, you're not lucky.
This is,
let me see, the third encounter. You are right, said Harry. This is the third encounter. Twice you have worsted me. Have you never heard that the third time the luck changes? This is my round. Cover him, Anne.
I was all ready. In a flash I had whipped the pistol out of my stocking and was holding it to his head. The two men guarding Harry sprang forward, but his voice stopped them.
Another step and he dies. If they come any nearer, Anne, pull the trigger. Don't hesitate.
I shan't, I replied cheerfully. I'm rather afraid of pulling it anyway.
I think Sir Eustace shared my fears. He was certainly shaking like a jelly.
Stay where you are, he commanded, and the men stopped obediently. Tell them to leave the room, said Harry.
Sir Eustace gave the order. The men filed out, and Harry shot the bolt across the door behind them.
Now we can talk, he observed grimly, and coming across the room, he took the revolver out of my hand.
Sir Eustace uttered a sigh of relief and wiped his forehead with a handkerchief.
I'm shockingly out of condition, he observed. I think I must have a weak heart. I'm glad that revolver is in competent hands. I didn't trust Miss Anne with it. Well, my young friend, as you say, now we can talk. I'm willing to admit that you stole a march upon me. Where the devil that revolver came from, I don't know. I had the girl's luggage searched when she arrived. And where did you produce it from now? You hadn't got it on you a minute ago.
Yes, I had, I replied. It was in my stocking.
I don't know enough about women. I ought to have studied them more, said Sir Eustace sadly. I wonder if Paget would have known that.
Harry rapped sharply on the table.
Don't play the fool.
If it weren't for your grey hairs, I'd throw you out of the window, you damn scoundrel. Grey hairs or no grey hairs, I... He advanced a step or two, and Sir Eustace skipped nimbly behind the table.
The young are always so violent, he said reproachfully. Unable to use their brains, they rely solely on their muscles. Let us talk sense. For the moment, you have the upper hand. But that state of affairs cannot continue. The house is full of my men. You are hopelessly outnumbered. Your momentary ascendancy has been gained by an accident.
Has it? Something in Harry's voice, a grim raillery, seemed to attract Sir Eustace's attention. He stared at him.
Has it?
Said Harry again.
Sit down, Sir Eustace, and listen to what I have to say.
Still covering him with the revolver, he went on. The cards are against you this time. To begin with, listen to that. That was a dull banging on the door below. There were shouts, oaths, and then a sound of firing. Sir Eustace paled.
What's that?
Race and his people. You didn't know, did you, Sir Eustace, that Anne had an arrangement with me by which we should know whether communications from one to the other were genuine? Telegrams were to be signed Andy,
Letters were to have the word "and" crossed out somewhere in them. Anne knew that your telegram was a fake. She came here of her own free will, walked deliberately into the snare, in the hope that she might catch you in your own trap. Before leaving Kimberley, she wired both to me and to Race. Mrs. Blair has been in communication with us ever since. I received the letter written at your dictation, which was just what I expected. I had already discussed the probabilities of a secret passage leading out of the curio shop with Race, and he had discovered the place where the exit was situated. There was a screaming, tearing sound, and a heavy explosion which shook the room. They're shelling this part of the town. I must get you out of here, Anne. A bright light flared up. The house opposite was on fire. Sir Eustace had risen and was pacing up and down. Harry kept him covered with the revolver. So you see, Sir Eustace, the game is up. It was you yourself who very kindly provided us with the clue of your whereabouts. Race's men were watching the exit of the secret passage. In spite of the precautions you took, they were successful in following me here. Sir Eustace turned suddenly.
Very clever. Very creditable. But I've still a word to say. If I've lost the trick, so have you. You'll never be able to bring the murder of Nadina home to me. I was in Marlowe on that day. That's all you've got against me. No one can prove that I even knew the woman. But you knew her. You had a motive for killing her, and your record's against you. You're a thief, remember? A thief. There's one thing you don't know, perhaps. I've got the diamonds, and here goes. With an incredible swift movement, he stooped, swung up his arm, and threw. There was a tinkle of breaking glass as the object went through the window and disappeared into the blazing mass opposite. There goes your only hope of establishing your innocence over the Kimberley affair. And now we'll talk. I'll drive a bargain with you. You've got me cornered. Race will find all he needs in this house. There's a chance for me if I can get away.
I'm done for if I stay. But so are you, young man.
There's a skylight in the next room. A couple of minutes' start, and I shall be all right. I've got one or two little arrangements already made. You let me out of the way and give me a start, and I'll leave you a signed confession that I killed Nadina.
Yes, Harry, I cried. Yes, yes, yes. He turned a stern face on me.
No, Anne. 1,000 times no. You don't know what you're saying.
I do. It solves everything.
I'd never be able to look Race in the face again. I'll take my chance, but I'm damned if I'll let this slippery old fox get away. It's no good, Anne. I won't do it.
Sir Eustace chuckled. He accepted defeat without the least emotion.
Well, well, he remarked. You seem to have met your master, Anne, but I can assure you both that moral rectitude does not always pay.
There was a crash of rending wood, and footsteps surged up the stairs. Harry drew back the bolt. Colonel Race was the first to enter the room, his face lit at the sight of us.
You're safe, Anne. I was afraid. He turned to Sir Eustace. I've been after you for a long time, peddler, and at last I've got you.
Everybody seems to have gone completely mad, declared Sir Eustace airily. These young people have been threatening me with revolvers and accusing me of the most shocking things. I don't know what it's all about.
Don't you? It means that I've found the colonel. It means that on January the 8th last, you were not in Cannes, but at Marlowe. It means that when your tool, Madame Nadina, turned against you, you planned to do away with her, and at last we shall be able to bring the crime home to you.
Indeed. And from whom did you get all this interesting information? From the man who is even now being looked for by the police? His evidence will be very valuable.
We have other evidence. There was someone else who knew that Nadina was going to meet you at the Mill House.
Sir Eustace looked surprised. Colonel Race made a gesture with his hand. Arthur Minx, alias the Reverend Edward Chichester, alias Miss Pettigrew, stepped forward. He was pale and nervous, but he spoke clearly enough.
I saw Nadina in Paris the night before she went over to England. I was posing at the time as a Russian count. She told me of her purpose. I warned her, knowing what kind of man she had to deal with, but she did not take my advice. There was a wireless message on the table. I read it. Afterwards, I thought I would have a try for the diamonds myself. In Johannesburg, Mr. Rayburn accosted me. He persuaded me to come over to his side. Sir Eustace looked at him. He said nothing, but Minx seemed visibly to wilt.
"Rats always leave a sinking ship," observed Sir Eustace. "I don't care for rats. Sooner or later I destroy vermin."
"There's just one thing I'd like to tell you, Sir Eustace," I remarked. "That tin you threw out of the window didn't contain the diamonds. It had common pebbles in it. The diamonds are in a perfectly safe place. As a matter of fact, they're in the giraffe's stomach. Suzanne hollowed it out, put the diamonds in with cotton wool so they wouldn't rattle, and plugged it up again." Sir Eustace looked at me for some time. His reply was characteristic.
"I always did hate that blinking giraffe," he said. "It must have been instinct."
Chapter 34. We were not able to return to Johannesburg that night. The shells were coming over pretty fast, and I gathered that we were now more or less cut off, owing to the rebels having obtained possession of a new part of the suburbs. Our place of refuge was a farm, some 20 miles or so from Johannesburg, right out on the veldt. I was dropping with fatigue. All the excitement and anxiety of the last 2 days had left me little better than a limp rag. I kept repeating to myself, without being able to believe it, that our troubles were really over. Harry and I were together, and we should never be separated again. Yet all through I was conscious of some barrier between us, a constraint on his part, the reason of which I could not fathom. Sir Eustace had been driven off in an opposite direction, accompanied by a strong guard. He waved his hand airily to us on departing. I came out onto the stoop early on the following morning and looked across the veld in the direction of Johannesburg. I could see the great dumps glistening in the pale morning sunshine, and I could hear the low rumbling mutter of the guns. The revolution was not over yet. The farmer's wife came out and called me in to breakfast. She was a kind, motherly soul, and I was already very fond of her. Harry had gone out at dawn and had not yet returned, so she informed me. Again, I felt a stir of uneasiness pass over me. What was this shadow of which I was so conscious between us? After breakfast, I sat out on the stoop, a book in my hand, which I did not read. I was so lost in my own thoughts that I never saw Colonel Raith ride up and dismount from his horse. It was not until he said, "Good morning, Anne," that I became aware of his presence. "Oh," I said with a flush, "it's you."
"Yes, may I sit down?"
He drew a chair up beside me. It was the first time we had been alone together since that day at Matapos. As always, I felt that curious mixture of fascination and fear that he never failed to inspire in me. "What is the news?" I asked.
"Smuts will be in Johannesburg tomorrow. I give this outbreak 3 days more before it collapses utterly. In the meantime, the fighting goes on."
"I wish," I said, "that one could be sure that the right people were the ones to get killed. I mean, the ones who wanted to fight, not just all the poor people who happen to live in the parts where the fighting is going on."
He nodded. "I know what you mean, Anne. That's the unfairness of war. But I've other news for you."
"Yes?"
"A confession of incompetency on my part. Pedler has managed to escape."
"What?"
"Yes. No one knows how he managed it. He was securely locked up for the night, in an upper-story room of one of the farm's roundabouts, which the military have taken over. But this morning the room was empty and the bird had flown."
Secretly, I was rather pleased. Never to this day have I been able to rid myself of a sneaking fondness for Sir Eustace. I dare say it's reprehensible, but there it is. I admired him. He was a thoroughgoing villain, I dare say, but he was a pleasant one. I've never met anyone half so amusing since. I concealed my feelings, of course. Naturally, Colonel Race would feel quite differently about it. He wanted Sir Eustace brought to justice. There was nothing very surprising in his escape, when one came to think of it. All round Joburg, he must have innumerable spies and agents, and whatever Colonel Race might think, I was exceedingly doubtful that they would ever catch him. He probably had a well-planned line of retreat. Indeed, he had said as much to us.
I expressed myself suitably, though in a rather lukewarm manner, and the conversation languished. Then Colonel Raist asked suddenly for Harry. I told him that he'd gone off at dawn and that I hadn't seen him this morning.
You understand, don't you, Anne, that apart from formalities, he is completely cleared? There are technicalities, of course, but Sir Eustace's guilt is well assured. There is nothing now to keep you apart.
He said this without looking at me, in a slow, jerky voice. I understand, I said gratefully.
And there is no reason why he should not at once resume his real name?
No, of course not.
You know his real name?
The question surprised me. Of course I do. Harry Lucas. He did not answer, and something in the quality of his silence struck me as peculiar.
Anne, do you remember that as we drove home from the Matterpos that day, I told you that I knew what I had to do?
Of course I remember.
I think I may fairly say I have done it. The man you love is cleared of suspicion.
Was that what you meant?
Of course.
I hung my head, ashamed of the baser suspicion I had entertained. He spoke again in a thoughtful voice.
When I was a mere youngster, I was in love with a girl who jilted me. After that, I thought only of my work. My career meant everything to me. Then I met you, Anne. And all that seemed worth nothing. But youth calls to youth. I've still got my work.
I was silent. I suppose one can't really love two men at once. But you can feel like it. The magnetism of this man was very great. I looked up at him suddenly. I think that you'll go very far, I said dreamily. I think that you've got a great career ahead of you. You'll be one of the world's big men. I felt as though I was uttering a prophecy.
I shall be alone, though.
All the people who do really big things are.
You think so?
I'm sure of it. He took my hand and said in a low voice,
I'd rather have had the other.
Then Harry came striding round the corner of the house. Colonel Raist rose.
Good morning, Lucas, he said.
For some reason, Harry flushed up to the roots of his hair. Yes, I said gaily, you must be known by your real name now. But Harry was still staring at Colonel Raist.
So, you know, sir, he said at last. I never forget a face. I saw you once as a boy.
What's this all about? I asked, puzzled, looking from one to the other. It seemed a conflict of wills between them. Race won. Harry turned slightly away.
I suppose you're right, sir.
Tell her my real name.
Anne, this isn't Harry Lucas. Harry Lucas was killed in the war. This is John Harold Eardsley.
Chapter 35. With his last words, Colonel Raist had swung away and left us. I stood staring after him. Harry's voice recalled me to myself. Anne, forgive me. Say you forgive me. He took my hand in his and almost mechanically I drew it away. Why did you deceive me?
I don't know that I can make you understand. I was afraid of all that sort of thing, the power and fascination of wealth. I wanted you to care for me, just for myself, for the man I was, without ornaments and trappings.
You mean you didn't trust me?
You can put it that way if you like, but it isn't quite true. I'd become embittered, suspicious, always prone to look for ulterior motives, and it was so wonderful to be cared for in the way you cared for me.
I see, I said slowly. I was going over in my mind the story he had told me. For the first time I noted discrepancies in it, which I had disregarded. An assurance of money, the power to buy back the diamonds of Nadina, the way in which he had preferred to speak of both men from the point of view of an outsider. And when he had said, my friend, he had meant not Eardsley, but Lucas. It was Lucas, the quiet fellow, who had loved Nadina so deeply. How did it come about, I asked.
Oh, we were both reckless, anxious to get killed. One night we exchanged identification discs. For luck, Lucas was killed the next day, blown to pieces.
I shuddered. But why didn't you tell me now, this morning? You couldn't have doubted my caring for you by this time.
Anne, I didn't want to spoil it all. I wanted to take you back to the island. What's the good of money? It can't buy happiness. We'd have been happy on the island. I tell you, I'm afraid of that other life. It nearly rotted me through once.
Did Sir Eustace know who you really were?
Oh, yes.
And Carton?
No. He saw us both with Nadina at Kimberley one night, but he didn't know which was which. He accepted my statement that I was Lucas and Nadina was deceived by his cable. She was never afraid of Lucas. He was a quiet chap, very deep. But I always had the devil's own temper. She'd have been scared out of her life if she'd known that I'd come to life again.
Harry, if Colonel Race hadn't told me, what did you mean to do?
Say nothing. Go on as Lucas.
And your father's millions?
Race was welcome to them. Anyway, he would make a better use of them than I ever shall.
Anne, what are you thinking about? You're frowning so. I'm thinking, I said slowly, that I almost wish Colonel Race hadn't made you tell me.
No, he was right. I owed you the truth.
He paused, then said suddenly, You know, Anne, I'm jealous of Race. He loves you too, and he's a bigger man than I am or ever shall be.
I turned to him laughing.
Harry, you idiot. It's you I want, and that's all that matters. As soon as possible, we started for Cape Town. There Suzanne was waiting to greet me, and we disemboweled the big giraffe together. When the revolution was finally quelled, Colonel Race came down to Cape Town, and at his suggestion, the big villa at Moisenberg that had belonged to Sir Lawrence Eardsley was reopened, and we all took up our abode in it. There we made our plans. I was to return to England with Suzanne and to be married from her house in London, and the trousseau was to be bought in Paris. Suzanne enjoyed planning all these details enormously. So did I. And yet the future seemed curiously unreal. And sometimes, without knowing why, I felt absolutely stifled, as though I couldn't breathe. It was the night before we were to sail. I couldn't sleep. I was miserable, and I didn't know why. I hated leaving Africa. When I came back to it, would it be the same thing? Would it ever be the same thing again? And then I was startled by an authoritative rap on the shutter. I sprang up. Harry was on the stoop outside.
Put some clothes on, Anne, and come out. I want to speak to you.
I huddled on a few garments and stepped out into the cool night air, still and scented with its velvety feel. Harry beckoned me out of earshot of the house. His face looked pale and determined, and his eyes were blazing.
Anne, do you remember saying to me once that women enjoyed doing things they disliked for the sake of someone they liked?
Yes, I said, wondering what was coming. He caught me in his arms.
Anne, come away with me now.
Tonight. Back to Rhodesia. Back to the island. I can't stand all this tomfoolery. I can't wait for you any longer. I disengaged myself a minute. And what about my French frocks? I lamented mockingly. To this day, Harry never knows when I'm in earnest and when I'm only teasing him. Damn your French frocks. Do you think I want to put frocks on you? I'm a damn sight more likely to want to tear them off you. I'm not going to let you go, do you hear? You're my woman. If I let you go away, I may lose you. I'm never sure of you. You're coming with me now, tonight, and damn everybody. He held me to him, kissing me until I could hardly breathe. I can't do without you any longer, Anne. I can't indeed. I hate all this money. Let Race have it. Come on, let's go.
My toothbrush? I demurred.
You can buy one. I know I'm a lunatic, but for God's sake, come.
He stalked off at a furious pace. I followed him as meekly as the Barozzi woman I had observed at the falls. Only I wasn't carrying a frying pan on my head. He walked so fast that it was very difficult to keep up with him.
Harry, I said at last in a meek voice, are we going to walk all the way to Rhodesia?
He turned suddenly and with a great shout of laughter gathered me up in his arms. I'm mad, sweetheart, I know. But I do love you so. We're a couple of lunatics. And oh, Harry, you never asked me, but I'm not making a sacrifice at all. I wanted to come. Chapter 36. That was 2 years ago. We still live on the island. Before me, on the rough wooden table, is the letter that Suzanne wrote me. Dear babes in the wood, dear lunatics in love, I'm not surprised, not at all. All the time we've been talking Paris and frocks, I felt that it wasn't a bit real, that you'd vanish into the blue some day, to be married over the tongs in the good old gypsy fashion. But you are a couple of lunatics. This idea of renouncing a vast fortune is absurd. Colonel Race wanted to argue the matter, but I have persuaded him to leave the argument to time. He can administer the estate for Harry, and none better, because after all, honeymoons don't last forever. You're not here, Anne, so I can safely say that without having you fly out at me like a little wildcat. Love in the wilderness will last a good while, but one day you will suddenly begin to dream of houses in Park Lane, sumptuous furs, Paris frocks, and the largest thing in motors, and the latest thing in perambulators, French maids and Norland nurses. Oh, yes, you will. But have your honeymoon, dear lunatics, and let it be a long one. And think of me sometimes, comfortably putting on weight amidst the flesh pots. Your loving friend, Suzanne Blair. P.S. I'm sending you an assortment of frying pans as a wedding present, and an enormous tureen of pâté de foie gras to remind you of me. There is another letter that I sometimes read. It came a good while after the other and was accompanied by a bulky parcel. It appeared to be written from somewhere in Bolivia.
My dear Anne Bedingfeld, I can't resist writing to you, not so much for the pleasure it gives me to write, as for the enormous pleasure I know it will give you to hear from me. Our friend Race wasn't quite as clever as he thought himself, was he? I think I shall appoint you my literary executor. I'm sending you my diary. There's nothing in it that would interest Race and his crowd, but I fancy that there are passages in it which may amuse you. Make use of it in any way you like. I suggest an article for the Daily Budget, Criminals I Have Met. I only stipulate that I shall be the central figure. By this time, I have no doubt that you are no longer Anne Bedingfeld, but Lady Eardsley, queening it in Park Lane. I should just like to say that I bear you no malice whatever. It is hard, of course, to have to begin all over again at my time of life, but entre nous, I had a little reserve fund carefully put aside for such a contingency. It has come in very useful, and I am getting together a nice little connection. By the way, if you ever come across that funny friend of yours, Arthur Minks, just tell him that I haven't forgotten him, will you? That will give him a nasty jar. On the whole, I think I have displayed a most Christian and forgiving spirit, even to Paget. I happened to hear that he, or rather Mrs. Paget, had brought a sixth child into the world the other day. England will be entirely populated by Paget soon. I sent the child a silver mug, and on a postcard declared my willingness to act as godfather. I can see Paget taking both mug and postcard straight to Scotland Yard without a smile on his face. Bless you, liquid eyes. Some day you will see what a mistake you have made in not marrying me. Yours ever, Eustace Pedler.
Harry was furious. It is the one point on which he and I do not see eye to eye. To him, Sir Eustace was the man who tried to murder me and whom he regards as responsible for the death of his friend. Sir Eustace's attempts on my life have always puzzled me. They are not in the picture, so to speak, for I am sure that he always had a genuinely kindly feeling towards me. Then why did he twice attempt to take my life? Harry says, because he's a damn scoundrel, and seems to think that settles the matter. Suzanne was more discriminating. I talked it over with her, and she put it down to a fear complex. Suzanne goes in rather for psychoanalysis. She pointed out to me that Sir Eustace's whole life was actuated by a desire to be safe and comfortable. He had an acute sense of self-preservation, and the murder of Nadina removed certain inhibitions. His actions did not represent the state of his feelings towards me, but were the result of his acute fears for his own safety. I think Suzanne is right. As for Nadina, she was the kind of woman who deserved to die. Men do all sorts of questionable things in order to get rich, But women shouldn't pretend to be in love when they aren't for ulterior motives. I can forgive Sir Eustace easily enough, but I shall never forgive Nadina. Never, never, never. The other day, I was unpacking some tins that were wrapped in bits of an old Daily Budget, and I suddenly came upon the words, "The man in the brown suit." How long ago it seemed. I had, of course, severed my connection with the Daily Budget long ago. I had done with it sooner than it had done with me. My romantic wedding was given a halo of publicity. My son is lying in the sun, kicking his legs. There's a man in a brown suit, if you like. He's wearing as little as possible, which is the best costume for Africa, and is brown as a berry. He's always burrowing in the earth. I think he takes after Papa. He'll have that same mania for Pleistocene clay. Suzanne sent me a cable when he was born. Congratulations and love to the latest arrival on Lunatic's Island. Is his head dolichocephalic or brachycephalic? I wasn't going to stand that from Suzanne. I sent her a reply of one word, economical and to the point. Platycephalic.
This recording of The Man in the Brown Suit by Agatha Christie was presented by Dreamscape Media LLC. Sound recording copyright 2020, Dreamscape Media LLC. Thank you for listening. Please check dreamscapeab.com for Dreamscape's latest releases.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.